So I was curious how long you've been emeritus at the university. Did you start, or I guess you retired from official capacity when, about 2006 or?
Yeah, well, I said I don't really remember. Carl might. We both retired at the same time.
Okay. But the university provides you with an office?
Yes. Yeah. But that's all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, it's kind of them. I imagine that if a great scarcity, say, for developed, that they would push us even closer together. I mean, my office was like this and this. I mean, it was twice as big as this.
Uh-huh.
Now it's half as big.
You come into the office every day, or just every now and then, or?
It depends, really, but I am here much more often than at home.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, at home, it's only, let's say, if there is a Friday, and we could go either here, we go for a long walk along in the river valley, mm-hmm. It's very pretty. Or we drive out somewhere and you go for a walk. So, in this sense, and when I come, I would be around 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't come at 7:30. I would be at about 10 o'clock. I'll come and I'll leave at about 2 o'clock. So mm-hmm. I don't spend really that much time here.
So I just want to get this for the record. You rode your bike from home to here.
Yeah.
This morning.
Yeah.
So you bike back and forth. You say it's about 15 minutes bike ride?
Yeah, or a bit more. Yeah. With the biking, it's actually pleasant. It's fun to ride it. Just that now they're doing a lot of street repairs, and that can be a nuisance because there are all these, you have to dismount because a big truck is to go this way but otherwise it's I really enjoy it. In fact, sometimes Beverly and I will go on we have sort of two things, either on foot or on bikes, and we have a very nice route with bikes where we cross the one bridge, go to the other side, mm-hmm. and then there's quite a lot of stuff here especially for bikes.
Mm.
And so then you also feel much safer because there's no cars, nothing, it's just bikes and pedestrians. So you have to watch that you don't bump into a pedestrian. And so it's actually, in this sense, the bike is very useful. In the winter, no biking.
No, yeah, right.
Yeah. I fell off a bike once, and it's if you fall on cement or so, it's rather unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And so. Took me a while to not limp anymore.
And so, just for the record as well, you're You were born in 1926, so you're probably, what, 86?
86.
86, going on 87.
Yeah.
And you and your wife are still biking around town.
She's 3 years younger.
Okay. Well, that's good. Then you say in the winter you actually do
cross-country.
Cross-country.
Well, hi, Brian. Yeah. We used to do a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, in the photos that I had given you, that sort of consists of, there's a hut somewhere in the mountains,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, well, you have to actually, you pay for the thing. There's a hut, you get a small bedroom, and the food is, in, you know, there's pretty good food.
Mm-hmm.
And then, every day, at about 9:30, 10, we have a guide, because there's a danger of two things, avalanches,
mm-hmm.
and what was the other one? Cornices.
What was that last one?
Cornice. But the cornice is, at the ridge of the mountain, and there's a prevailing wind from this side, and as it blows, it carries a bit of snow particles,
mm-hmm.
and then they form a cornice.
Like a lip or a
so shelf. It is. So it's actually just like this,
mm-hmm.
and it's very weak if you go on it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going here, you have no idea that this is here.
Yeah.
So a guide is very useful in this respect. He knows this is a cornice. He knows this can be an avalanche here. So we always had a guide. But once Beverly made a mistake. We had fallen behind. And actually she wanted to pee.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd fallen behind just for that reason. And now she wanted kinda to be on a hidden place, and she walked out. We were on the ridge. She walked out this way, and she did her thing, and we heard a noise, but we couldn't make out what it was. And then we went back. Then we see a group of people. This was another group that was going. And they were as mad as hell. And they said, who did that? What? Who did make this? And when the cornice falls, it fell on a steep slope with a lot of powder snow and triggered an avalanche. And this avalanche ran. And there was another group going, and suddenly they see this thing coming. But fortunately, it stopped. It could have killed there, you know, because digging them out.
Oh, yeah.
You know. So that was, you know, in a sense, it was very nice to go in the mountains, but you had to. It wasn't like on a ski hill where there's yo-yo things and, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's definitely an important thing to have somebody who knows the lay of the land and the lay of the snow.
Yes. Similar in the winter. We have grizzly bears here.
Oh, really?
So that's one sometimes unpleasant encounter. That you walk, and then you see a grizzly. And again, we had a guide, and it was a woman. And we saw that grizzly just sitting there. She said, don't worry, this grizzly, they're just friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, in this case, we went by the grizzly just sitting. But 2 years later, we hear that this same guy had been going down the mountain, and somehow, she was with another young woman, somehow they had not noticed, but there was a grizzly. And, you know, they get scared, and the bear gets upset, and so he now goes towards them.
Mm-hmm.
And challenging way. But they were near a tree, bush type of thing. And they climbed on that tree. And the bear sat there, the bear. They spent the night. And she was a guy, so we meet her. And we knew of the episode, and she said, "When are you going back?" "Never."
You don't want to spend any more nights up in the tree.
Yeah.
And so you were teaching classes up until retirement, retired? Or
yes. Yeah.
And did the university, you said they were liberal. I mean, some places want you to retire at age 65, and others...
You what?
Some want you to retire at a specific age.
Yeah.
And others don't care. I guess the policy here about retirement, yeah, is pretty liberal.
I think they had one and then they had the other. Now I think they're letting people stay longer.
Okay.
But they had, when I was essentially kicked out, certainly no salary, but the pensions were good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have I guess I stayed quite a long time. I have a very high pension.
Mm-hmm.
So in on the financial thing, there was no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But so I was kind of neutral. I have more time, you know, I've given so many lectures.
Mm-hmm.
So why not stop?
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to revisit was something we discussed at lunch, and that is that when you left Bulgaria, then you really left your family behind, and
yeah,
never really went back or either saw your mother or father or any of your other family after,
yeah,
that.
What happened is that gradually... like Bulgaria now is quite democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually their sort of restrictions. Furthermore, by that time they were both quite old. So they could not be an enemy of the state,
mm-hmm,
because they barely walked.
Mm-hmm.
And probably if they're sick, they have to go to a hospital. So then they let them go.
Mm-hmm.
So they showed up by that time I was already living in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But they showed up, and my brother, who is 5 years older than I am, and also a chemist, and he was interested in pharmaceuticals, and he took his PhD in Zurich with a famous guy, Paul Carrer, that had, there were studying in the Amazon. There were Indians there, whatever you call them, and they had bows and arrows still, and they used a kind of a material that that the tip of the arrow, they dip into this, and it would paralyze. So that is, and so then it was a question that may be a nice way to anesthetize people. So they were doing research, and his supervisor was an older Swiss who had a Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Paul Karrer.
K-A-R-R-E-R.
Karrer.
Okay.
Yeah. So my brother's name is Heine. Had to be very careful not to prick his finger when he works with this thing because he gets paralyzed.
So how do you spell his name? H, your brother?
Heine. Heinrich. Henry.
H-E-I-N-R-I-C-H.
Henry. So in German it's Heinrich. H-E-I-N-R-I-C-H.
Okay.
It's the Henry in English.
Sure. And he ended up with a PhD in chemistry also.
Yes, so when he got his PhD, Switzerland is very strong on pharmaceutical.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a company called Siva, maybe you heard of them.
CIVA.
Siva, and later they joined with a more fertilizer type of thing, company called Geigy. Geigy. So it's Siva Geigy.
Yeah.
And he went to work for them and was very successful, promoted, etc. But then they have compulsory retirement. But he had a fat pension. He's still alive in good health.
And is he still in Europe then?
Sorry?
Your brother is still
in Basel, Switzerland, yeah.
And so you say your parents could leave?
They left Bulgaria, and then, my father knew German, so they stayed in Basel, with a sort of in a little one-room apartment, near to where my brother lived.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father died of a stroke, and my mother died later. Yeah.
But basically, once you left Bulgaria, then you never really saw them again.
No, I didn't.
One of the papers that was pointed out to me was this work. Apparently, you were having, I don't know if it was a competition or a discussion with someone about whether you could ionize something with alpha particles versus electrons. In some of those early papers, let me see if I can get the title of that paper. There was a couple of early papers that.
Well, I think that when I started work at high pressures, you had to have a way to ionize the molecules that you want to do mass spec with, because they have to have a charge.
Right.
So you, to ionize them, you either put a proton on them or you pull an H minus. away. So it must be something like this.
Well, there's studies of ions from the alpha particle irradiation of gases at high pressures. Is the paper.
Yes, yeah.
And I guess there was a discussion or a question as to whether or not you could do that by using alpha particle irradiation.
Well, there was another thing that after the wars had ended, you know, this the European wars, and the Americans started developing a nuclear bomb. And there became the question, what to do if somebody was exposed to high radioactivity or something like this. Yeah, and so I think a certain amount of research was done on the interactions between, you know, alpha particles and something I've forgotten now, but in search of possible material that would protect or cure. So alpha particles just ionize, they're highly accelerated and fly. If they fly fast, they'll ionize other molecules. So you could use it as a sort of ionization rather than, say, using fast electrons as you do with a mass spec. So ionized with alpha particles.
And so that worked by moving an electron or attachment?
Sorry?
Would that work by collision that removed an electron or by
attachment? It's a natural process. It falls apart. It has a lifetime. So once it's fallen apart, that thing will not do anything more. But you have a certain amount of this material, and say the half-life may be 100 years or 20 years. Gradually, as the particles are shot out, this is finished. So that's a form with which you can ionize. It's a convenient form rather than a filament. Although, like it can work at high pressures, which a filament can't do because it will burn if there was oxygen. It will burn out. So we did some work with alpha particles. We got them from. This is again a period of first nuclear bombs and so on. And they had a company supplying the Americans, and we could order a little source with alpha particles, and they sent it to us. The one advantage was that they interact so strongly that they can't come out. So if they're in a closed box, you're not much exposed to any radiation.
So after they do the ionization, they end up running into the sides of the chamber, and they can't get through the chamber.
Well, I think they send it to us I don't know how it came. It doesn't have a, it interacts so strongly, say it's a plus to plus and heavy, and somehow it doesn't radiate farther than, let's say, this. It exhausts itself. I think it was something like this, I must say that. Yeah. But we were always careful to.
You were aware of the hazards.
Yes.
And so it seems like there's a lot of work in ionization cross sections, charge transfer, fragmentation.
Yeah.
Photosensitization. How did you mercury? So use the mercury lamp to photosynthesize compounds. Xenon sensitized ionization of ethylene. So you would essentially deposit energy into the molecule with photo energy, photons into the molecule to change the ionization potential?
Well, photoionization, I guess, the way, is that it's using light. So you won't get photoionization shining the light on this linoleum, but if you have certain materials, maybe, I think that's what's called photoionization, is that that can activate, especially might be totally wrong, but suppose that you're in the ultraviolet or so on, where it has more power. We did work with these things, and I ordered them, and they come, and you have to keep them with great care in a kind of a box, a metal box, and so on. But at the end, we switched back to filament, like in a mass spectrometer, and to protect it from burning out, we had we removed all, we had very, very, very high pump, very large pumps, so these diffusion pumps were about that wide. And maybe there's one this big and another this big. And there's very, very little gas in the thing over. But
Let's see. So basically, on the work side, you are currently pretty much retired. You're not doing any science at this point in your life.
No, yeah.
But I guess it's okay.
Sorry?
I guess that's okay.
What I would say is that, at 86, your intellectual powers are greatly reduced. And and you forget a lot of the stuff that you knew. You just forget at that age.
So do you have any sense of the impact of your research in to field of mass spectrometry, is whether it would make much of an impact or
I would say that it made an impact at the time. But it has not made an impact that till today. there's also a certain amount of like fashion or so. Some research gets going.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, but it's not really necessary for humanity to. But in terms of science providing more of a background to science,
mm-hmm.
there it can do. So some of the stuff would go in the textbooks. In this sense, a contribution was made, that these were things, and somebody else may pick it up and make an additional thing, and maybe he gets his name, but he was inspired by the previous work
mm-hmm.
to do something that, so in a sense also, gradually, while initially a lot of people knew of you, gradually you fade away, even though you might have provided a basis for certain things.
Well, I don't know about fading away. You have some very highly cited papers.
Sorry?
You have some very highly cited papers.
Yes. I think the last one.
Many highly cited papers.
I think the last one was the one of the most quoted. Let me see.
That one, of course, I think anything on electrospray back in the beginning was...
Yes.
...was really...
Yeah, probably one that has most quoted. Yes. It's, I don't know whether you have a list like this.
I do have that list. Probably that one.
But this is 253, Paul Kebarle and you. Udo Verkirk. That was my last postdoc.
Uh-huh.
A very bright guy. Electrospray from ions in solution to ions in the gas phase.
Mm-hmm.
What we know now. So with the electrospray, you have the ions in solution there. Mm-hmm. But now, with that spray of very small droplets, that evaporate very rapidly, and if the droplets they explode, and as it evaporates, because there is some charge that, and then, electrospray from ions in solution to ions in the gas phase, what we know now. So that was a review, but it's been very. The most quoted of all my papers.
That was in when 19.
The paper is 2009.
2009.
Yeah, Mass Spec Review.
Yes.
But I can give you the. Yes.
Yeah.
Udo Verkirk and Kebarle.
And MS Reviews, okay. You've got work going back to 1990 that was cited 100 times.
Which one is it?
I'm looking at a 1990 paper that was published in JAX, Production and Study of the Gas Phase of Morphically Charged Solvated or Coordinated Metal Ions.
Just a sec. 190 or
1993. I don't have them, unfortunately, by the number reference you have there, but it would have been 1993 paper on
1993.
Metal ions production in JACS, production and study in the gas phase of multiply charged, solvated, or coordinated metal ions. 1990.
Oh, it's 1990. Oh, okay.
If I've got it right.
Yeah. Well, I have Hirao and Kebarle. Maybe.
I'm looking at one by Jayawira.
Hirao?
No, Blades. Ikonomo. It's in JACS.
JACS?
Journal of American Chemical Society. 1990. By Jayawira, Palitha, Arthur Blades.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. That's just the one. That's over 100 sites.
Paper
number 199.
Is it 199?
Let me see. It's 196.
Ah, yes. 196. Jayawira, Blades, Ikonomo, Kebarle. Is that it?
Yeah. That's got over 120 sites.
Uh-huh. That's in JACS.
Yes.
Yeah. Production and study of gas phase in the gas phase of multiply charged, solvated, or coordinated metal ions.
Yeah, that was apparently a pretty popular paper.
Yes.
So it says in the abstract, a breakthrough into the hitherto inaccessible alkali earth and transition metal M++ gas phase ion chemistry is reported.
Yes. Well, I agree with that.
So what was that? Why was this so important?
I don't know.
The gas phase
ions. I would have to reread that thing. I mean, It's been 2013, so we're going...
It's been 23 years.
23 years. It's a little bit asking too much.
But there's a lot of your early work that has well over 100 sites.
Yeah.
What
happens is like this, is that at a given time, say some kind of breakthrough occurs in an area, and then a lot is published, and it's a group. It's like a group, and they're together doing this thing. And it will last maybe for 15 years or 10, 15. And then it peters out. Because, okay, now we know that. We move on. So at some point it moves on, and then it's seldom cited, but some continue for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's one of the interesting aspects of the digitization of data, is you can find now with FlatFinder how many times the paper has been cited in the literature, and then you can also get a listing of all the papers that cite that one paper. Uh-huh. So you can find out when it was cited last, who cited it, what they were studying at the time, and so on. So it's an interesting way of trying to reconstruct how events occurred, because you can see the impact that one paper has.
But you know, in a sense, science is like this. It goes on and on and on. And at a certain point, your old stuff is like a basis. Okay, you know, this is on sound thing. It's but people go on. And also there's a change. It's a change of interest, like now the change into bio. I mean, very typical. So people that did that kind of stuff now would not be paid. There's nobody that's interested in that stuff. Or very little, I'd say. A few very intelligent.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you have any other thoughts or comments or questions that you want to pursue about your career. That I've listed some names here that were primarily selected on the basis of the people that you published the most number of co-authors with. So these are all people who had
Most often. Yeah,
often.
I guess, do I have that copy?
Yeah,
I think you gave me that.
So I don't know if you want to comment something about your...
on the people that...
On those people, I assume they're mostly graduate students and postdocs that had worked with you and...
Blades Arthur is actually the same age as I am.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's a good friend. He, which I knew for some time, he was working for a provincial research laboratory. But they didn't know what to do there. They didn't have a... It was... They were doing very basic research. But this was a government institution that wanted to have modern. And so Blades was working for them and didn't budge when they told him that he should do other research, what they tell him. And so he quit and came to work with me. And I'd say he stayed about 10 years or so. And by that time we both were kind of... But he... That's him. Sonner is a Swede. So that Sonner is a Swede, who very bright. His father was a famous I forget exactly, it was more into medical thing.
Looks like you did some work on Fab towards the end of your collaboration there.
Sorry?
It looks like you did some work with Fab.
Yeah.
Towards the end of your collaboration with him. You know, various studies of basic modeling of fast atom bombardment.
Now, do you want the others?
Yeah, let's go through a couple
quickly,
others.
Quickly, yeah. So, there is Hiraoka Kenzo. We're still very good friends. He became professor in Japan and travels a great deal. He's very successful. And his wife is very sweet. Very nice people. So we're still very good friends. And he was here maybe 4 years ago, gave a talk.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There is Terry McMahon. He's in the very well known. You see that sort of towards the bottom, McMahon Terrence. He made a career. He's in the East. So McMahon was very, very bright and very hardworking. Caldwell. I think Gary Caldwell is the guy. We gave you some pictures.
Ah, okay.
And on one photo, there's a guy with his fist
at the
mass spec thing. I mean, he's acting because the circuits often gave out something. We then spend a whole day trying to find what's wrong. And so Gary would say, there she goes again. Eric Grimsrud is an American. So Caldwell, Gary, I don't know what he was, an Englishman. Eric Grimsrud is still a good, very good friend. He lives in the States. And he was professor. And now he's retired. John Klassen was my last PhD. And he is extremely successful. He was hired here, and he's in that new building that we passed through now,
okay,
the very new.
He
has there a number of mass spectrometers. He's done very well, and it's all bio. So that's John Klassen. So he did both his PhD and a postdoc with me. And Udo Verkirk.
He's relatively recent.
Sorry?
I say he's relatively recent. You published something with him in 2010 on the mechanical.
Well, let me see.
On the mechanism of electrospray ionization, ESIMS.
Which page are you on? Yeah, here, Udo Ficker. Peschke. Oh, yes. Sorry. Okay. Udo Ficker, brilliant guy. Really brilliant guy. We're still friends. Unfortunately, he did not manage to land an academic position. He's in Toronto. Brilliant guy. It's sad sometimes, somebody really absolutely outstanding. He has a job, but much less than of what he deserves. Yeah.
Those are unfortunate things that happen, but they
yeah, happen. It's a...
Okay, well, I think that covers most of the things that I had there. Told me quite a bit about your career, and
but that's fine.
I mean, we've got a pretty good list of your publications. I assume that while you've listed some in this one, you have these papers selected in benchmark papers in physical chemistry at the very end of your bibliography.
Yeah. There's so what about it? Yeah.
There's so these are papers that other people chose for inclusion in this list of benchmark papers. Solvation of hydrogen ion by water molecules in a gas phase.
Well, you know, these papers don't need to be so very special, but the journal gave itself the name Benchmark Papers in Physical Chemistry. And so then they invite you to, or whatever, they chose one and asked, I think that's the way it was. So I forget this, but because there are whole five papers there. I guess they were selected by somebody, as the best.
They look like they're pretty much thermodynamics related.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think, unless you have any other things that you want to say, at this point, we can wrap it up if you...
Yeah.
Unless you have anything else to say.
Well, that's fine. I mean, it's... I think we did cover a good amount of territory.
Mm-hmm.